We have made it to the end of the Bonded Vault series.
Thank goodness. It felt like we were never going to get out of it.
Well, it's not over yet. We still have to finish this episode.
Well, that's true. But the robbery and the trial are behind us. All that's left is what happened to the boys.
You mean we'll be done in under 20 minutes today?
If we stay on track. So, since this is our second episode this week, we'll skip the mailbag and get down to business.
Deal. I also think that we should leave Jerry Tillinghast for his own episode, but I do want to say that supposedly he never admitted to being involved in the heist.
Well, he was pretty open about his other activities, so I'm kind of inclined to believe that he wasn't involved.
Same here. Okay, so let's start off with Jacob Jake Tarzian. He beat the robbery charges he was facing in Connecticut in January of 1977. His alleged accomplices in that trial, McCaskill and Lanoue, were still on the lam.
Did DeSalt finger them for that robbery, too?
No, remember it was the guy who robbed the Fogg Museum?
Oh, yeah, the Fogg Museum. But poor Tarzian's story did not have a happy ending. He was shot to death on the 28th of August, 1985, outside his home in Millbury, Mass. When questioned later, the neighbors admitted that they had heard the gunshots at about 9 p.m., but they claimed that they assumed it was just a car backfiring on the highway nearby and did nothing. Tarzian had been shot 10 times in the back and chest, so much for the car backfiring story.
Hello.
His tied-up German Shepherd was also murdered. The two weren't found until the following morning by another neighbor walking by.
I want to fast forward to December of 1987 when Howie Winter's associate, Billy Gingras, was arrested for illegal possession of three machine guns. He had rented a storage unit 5 years earlier and never returned for the four boxes that he had stashed there. He hadn't paid his bill either, so eventually the owner of the storage company opened the locker and the boxes. Inside they found six shotguns, four rifles, 15 handguns, three machine guns, and 60 rounds of ammo.
Gingras, who ran an auto body shop, claimed that Jake Tarzian had given him the boxes as payment for services rendered, and Tarzian told him that the boxes contained silver. But Gingras never bothered to verify the contents and just dropped them off at the storage unit.
Do you buy that?
No, and the government didn't buy his claim either, and there's clearly much more to the story, but we will have to come back to it. Maybe when we do the Valhalla, since the authorities alleged that the weapons matched.
Well, that sounds like a plan. When Howie Winter was released from Leavenworth in May of 1985, he needed a job since he was on parole, and he landed at Gingras' auto body shop in Millbury, just a few minutes away from where Tarzian was living. And he wasn't there by coincidence. Didn't Gingras actually sponsor Howie for his parole?
Yes, he did. Semper Fi and all that. But that same summer, Jerry Angiulo and his brothers were on trial along with Sammy Granito. According to the papers at the time, 90% of the Fed's case was based on the wiretap at Jerry's that had run from January to May 1981. Howie's name came up several times on the tapes that were played in court that summer along with Stevie and Whitey. We'll be covering all of this in much more detail in later episodes, but I just wanted to mention it now because I believe that it's highly likely that Howie Winter killed Jake Tarzian either because of something that had come up in the tapes that were played in court or because of the Valhalla or some other dispute.
I had never put those pieces together, a new rabbit hole to venture down, but we're not going to do that today.
Not today, but I am still waiting for Howie's file. It is coming.
Yeah, well, look how long it took me to get Dad's file. What? 3 years? No, three and a half years.
They promised me that it was a lot of stuff, though, so we'll see. No. Okay, moving on to the deuce, let's get him out of the way and finish him off.
Okay, I agree. Literally. Go ahead.
DeSalt's deal with the feds did not exactly work out the way he thought it would. It never seems to have done, actually. He still had to serve time, just not in Massachusetts or Rhode Island. In a 1980 interview, he complained that he was recognized no matter where he went in the prison system. After a fellow inmate pulled a knife on him at McNeil Island in Washington, the deuce decided he'd had enough. He traded a carton of cigarettes for two coffee cans of gasoline. The next evening, he emptied the gas on the floor of his cell and lit a towel on fire. The screams of his cellmates alerted the guards who prevented him from setting the room alight.
What was that supposed to accomplish?
I guess to scare him that he proved that he was a nut.
I guess. Okay.
But he was sprung shortly after that.
Okay, so in September of 1982, Dussault was arrested in Minneapolis after attempting to rob the Rocky Mountain Coin and Stamp Exchange. Hold on, I want to reread that. In September of 1982, Dussault was arrested in Minneapolis after attempting to rob the Rocky Mountain Coin and Stamp Exchange in Denver, along with his cohort, Thomas Gage, who was shot in the arm after the owner of the shop freed himself. Coins and stamps were just too tempting for him, I think.
No comment. What I found interesting was that by the time of the botched robbery, there were 4,000 people in witness protection, and 90% of them were convicted criminals. Think about that, and the program was only 13 years old.
Well, the 90% number isn't a surprise. I mean, if you weren't in trouble, why would you need to go into witness protection? So the other 10% is like family members.
I guess. It's just they sold it to the public. I guess my problem is they sold it to the public like, oh, we're protecting the innocent.
Yeah, okay.
Well?
No. No.
Okay, that's how they sold it to the public. Okay. And 90% of them was a lie.
99% of them, because you said, what, 1 out of 4,000 actually wasn't a criminal?
No, I said in the interview, when they were interviewing people and for this thing, yep. One of the people that they interviewed was a woman who, you know, the neighbor did something and she saw it or something. I can't remember.
Okay, so she testified against them. So that's, yeah, okay, so that's something different. Okay, I gotcha.
But 90% of the people in the program, whatever number that would be, yeah, okay.
Okay, all right, okay, sorry. Move on.
Okay, anyway, in mid-December of 85, Dussault and a different accomplice robbed the Mutual State Bank in Omaha, Nebraska of nearly $21,000. The two men were arrested in Phoenix, Arizona on December 31st, shortly after robbing a bank there of $40,000 during the Fiesta Bowl parade. Both times, the Deuce was dressed as a security guard. He escaped 21 days later.
Did he ever commit a robbery that he didn't take a pinch for?
Who knows? I mean, if he did, you wouldn't know it, I guess, because that's kind of the point.
Yeah, true.
But researching him certainly makes you think the answer is no. The Deuce passed away on October 3rd, 1992, at the age of 51, while in custody of the feds in North Dakota. The death certificate was issued under Robert Dempsey, which was the name he had been using for roughly a decade. According to Tim White, when he interviewed Dussault's siblings, they told him that he had attended his mother's funeral some 2 years later, but White had seen a videotape of the Deuce's funeral that was recorded on VHS showing the service and the casket being lowered into the ground.
Two things. Didn't you say that the mother slash sister actually died in 97,
yes.
Not 94? Okay, so it was 5 years later that he was still kicking, supposedly. And why would they videotape back in the, I mean, I understand now that funerals are on Zoom. I mean, I deal with this for my work and stuff, and there's video recordings of it for people that can't travel. But back in those days, why would you put a funeral on VHS?
Unless you were trying to sell a narrative.
And I just don't think the feds would go to that much trouble for the Deuce, but who knows?
Well, maybe he went through the trouble for himself. I don't know. It was kind of weird. It's a weird story. But anyway, okay, our other songbird, Joe the Dancer DiNizzi. After testifying at length in the nearly 80-day-long trial, he did not ride off quietly into the night either. He was charged with armed robbery in Massachusetts in 1981. In 1988, he was convicted of extortion in Chesterfield, Virginia, and sentenced to 5 years. And he just couldn't stay out of trouble. Judge Felix Forte was right.
Indeed he was. In 1993, he was charged and convicted of check fraud and grand larceny. And it gets better. In April of 1998, at the age of 62, the dancer was pinched for robbing the Regency Bank in Henrico, Virginia on March 3rd.
He robbed the bank wearing a beige trench coat, a Planet Hollywood t-shirt, and a baseball cap while brandishing a toy pistol. The bank did not disclose the amount that DiNizzi made off with, but he was easily identified thanks to the camera system and observant bystanders. When the cops showed up at his apartment, his outfit was there along with 15 $2 bills.
There were also two photo albums containing clippings and other items that documented his criminal history that spanned over 40 years at that point. The police also disclosed that Dancer was a heroin addict.
Well, I know I was tasked with finding out whether or not the Dancer was still alive, but I couldn't come up with anything concrete after his release from prison in 2018.
Well, I know that you tried. Next up is John Ouimet. After being convicted, he didn't manage to stay out of trouble either. The following month, he was in court again on charges of having a phone in his cell that he was using to run gambling operations.
Well, he didn't deny the phone charge, but he did deny the gambling charge. And didn't his brother Jerry also have a phone in his cell?
Yeah, because he was the local leader of the prisoners' civil rights thing. Remember that from the first episode of this?
Oh, yeah. But the juice was in on that, too, in Massachusetts.
Exactly. Ouimet and Burns were freed in October of 1979, pending appeal. But on July 31, 1981, the Rhode Island Supreme Court upheld their conviction. Burns and Ouimet were ordered to turn themselves in. But guess what? The two men were on a deep-sea fishing trip. The state spent $18,000 searching for them throughout the month of August and into September without any success. The two men finally waltzed into court after 5 weeks and turned themselves in.
And that was only because the authorities threatened to take away their family's homes, including John's mother, sister, and daughter. In February of 1982, Rhode Island's first female public defender, Allegra Munson, was convicted of attempted larceny and forced to resign as a result of her romantic involvement with Ouimet. She was caught participating in a scheme to manufacture three illegal license plates at the ACI, one of them for her boyfriend, Ouimet.
I don't understand why he needed a license plate. Wasn't he in the can?
I don't know. Maybe for his weekend furloughs. Maybe Pro needed one.
Ugh.
Munson's law license was suspended for 3 months, and she was fined $500. But things were looking up. The couple married in September of that year at MCI Norfolk, where Ouimet was serving his sentence. Shortly after, Ouimet's new wife joined his legal team and organized the appeal process. Ouimet's appeal highlighted the fact that the prosecution had withheld Dussault's very extensive criminal record when they put him on the stand. Ouimet admitted to the court during his appeal that he only made $60,000 in the holdup.
Ouimet served 10 years for the bonded vault heist before his conviction was finally overturned in 1991 and he was released. But trouble seemed to follow him. He was convicted and sentenced in 1994 to 6 months in federal prison for defrauding an insurance company.
John Ouimet passed away in hospice care in March of 2017 at the age of 75. He was predeceased by his brother Jerry 2 years before. I have to say that the obit was very nicely done. He was described as always the gentleman, suave and debonair, and that he always sought a peaceful resolution to disputes.
Let's move on to Ralph Skippy Burns. Unlike the others, he had no other record besides the vault case. He appealed his case to federal court, but the appeal was denied. His sentence was later reduced to 35 years, and he was released to home confinement in 1987, at which time he remained on parole until 2010. Skippy passed away on February 13, 2018, of Alzheimer's disease.
Like Burns, Walter Ouimet also stayed out of trouble. He passed away on Tuesday, January 8, 2013, at the age of 65.
And now for Flynn, and then we are done.
I'd say we saved the best for last, but...
Well, at least we saved the most colorful character in this tale for last. In March of 1977, Flynn, along with Burns and Ouimet, declared that they were paupers and would be unable to pay the $15,000 that the state requested for a copy of the transcripts from the 79-day-long trial. The transcripts were necessary for their appeals.
And then the judge refused to label them indigent, so that didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
On August 9, 1978, bail was set at $50,000 in the Rhode Island court for the appeal of the bonded vault case. This was done as a technicality so that Flynn could be returned to Massachusetts to continue serving the 18 to 25-year sentence for armed robbery that was imposed on him before he was charged, tried, and convicted of the bonded vault case.
In early 1980, Flynn's attorney, Harvey Brower, was disbarred. The famous and infamous William Kunstler and John Cicilline were defending the trio during the appeals process. Kunstler contended that they were victims of prosecutorial misconduct.
I think we need another lawyer episode, especially because of Cicilline.
Oh, I agree. I think so, too. A little bit later, though.
In May of 81, the Schiavone murder trial was underway with Flynn and his co-defendant Ralph DeMassi. Jerry Tillinghast was also charged with Schiavone's murder but was being tried separately. I still don't understand how DeMassi never mentioned that he was locked up the day Schiavone was killed.
Forget about him. How the hell did the authorities not know? This was like when they arrested Dad for Fats Buccelli's murder, and Dad was still sitting locked up in Concord.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how do you arrest him? You didn't know that he was in Concord when the guy got killed? Same story.
So, anyway, okay, we're going to come back to that case because it really bugs me, and I think I know who did it, so
okay. Definitely
going to do it. Mm-hmm. Flynn's appeal case made it to the Supreme Court in March of 1986, and they reversed the appeal again. But being locked up didn't stop him from staying active in criminal activities. After the 1988 murder of Lowell bookie Jackie McDermott, the authorities named Flynn as an accomplice of Barnowski's, as the two men were alleged to want to take over the rackets in Lowell. This had allegedly been a longtime ambition of Chucky's, so the allegation wasn't exactly a stretch.
I don't know if I buy that. It sounds more like another Deuce fantasy. But Flynn reportedly had called McDermott from prison the night before he was killed. Nevertheless, Flynn was paroled by the summer of 1989, reunited with his bride Ellen in New Hampshire, and allegedly joined up with Bobby DeLuca's crew.
And the two men were indicted, and warrants for their arrest were issued in August of 1991 for being part of a gaming and loan sharking operation in Lowell. According to the papers at the time, quote, law enforcement officials have said that the mafia gave Flynn control of the rackets in Lowell in return for remaining silent about his co-conspirators in the bonded vault case, unquote. DeLuca and 15 others were arrested almost immediately, but Flynn was on the lam for 2 months before being pinched at the Dunkin' in the Winter Hill section of Somerville.
Oh my gosh, I didn't tell you. The Twin Donuts in Alston is closed. You remember the, you've never seen it, but the big sign, like it was that old retro sign that was there from the 1950s. That was one of Jack Kelly and Dad's favorite spots. All the old places are gone.
It's just, time moves on, nothing lasts forever, all the cliches, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But wasn't there something special about that particular Dunkin' Donuts?
Yeah, because it was near where the other boys, Mutterano and Flemmy and Salemi had the garage over there in Winter Hill. So that Dunkin' Donuts, everybody congregated over there. It was like the wise guy Dunkin' Donuts.
It just makes me wonder about who gave him up, though. But no. It does seem like half of Boston was informing at that point. So,
well, we've seen the informant numbers in the 302s, and literally there had to be more informants than there were actual criminals.
It's crazy.
Truly.
Anyway, the authorities also alleged that Flynn had led and participated in 6 armed robberies in New Hampshire between April and September of 1991. Flynn was convicted in November of 1992 on 19 charges, including armed robbery, firearms, and money laundering. The combined sentence would have been more than 200 years, but it was reduced to 47 years in March of 1993, and Chucky Flynn died in the pen at Lewisburg, Pennsylvania in 2001.
And I'm glad we skipped the tragedy of his son and grandson.
Thank God, that was too much for me.
And on that note, we are finally finished with the Bonded Vault, all 4 parts of it. So next week, we'll be on our normal schedule, and we will be back on Tuesday with the Hit Parade of 1976.
And I've already found some really good stuff, so stay tuned.
Yes, wonderful. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.